This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the book titled Tucson Memories, written by Bonnie Henry and published in 2006.
The title of this section is Hometown Notables, Number 4, Sandy Duckett. Not many women commuted by motorcycle, let alone raced them back in the 50s. This woman did. Usually I was the only woman, but not always, said Sandy Duckett, who vaguely remembered another female racing from time to time. Races were held weekday mornings on an old World War II auxiliary runway, about where the Marana Northwest Regional Airport would later go. It was one-on-one drag racing, no money, no prizes. There were 20 or 30 of us. We just all get together. So did the men ever give her a hard time? Nah, said Duckett. Well, maybe just once. I did hear about one guy I beat who supposedly went back to Phoenix and sold his machine. Though Duckett only raced for a year, she did jump back behind the handlebars a decade later when the Route 66 TV series filmed in Tucson. Somebody called up from the production company. I got my dad to babysit the kids, and I did the stunt riding for Julie Newmar, said Duckett. Her route was up toward the 6th Avenue underpass, nearly colliding with the TV show's trademark Corvette. Duckett also rode down a mountain near San Javier with a double for Martin Milner, one of the stars of the show. Credit the Korean War with Duckett's brush with fame. In 1951, her then-husband Lee, who was the proud owner of a Harley-Davidson, was sent to Korea. He told me, "If you can start it, you can ride it," said Duckett. "It was harder than hell to start. I would get home from work and practically pass out trying. Finally, she got the engine to turn over. I rode it every day to Grand Central where I was working. That sort of grit and gumption came early." Born in Ohio in 1925, Duckett, along with her parents, wound up in Las Vegas after the Depression left her dad jobless. When her father's hopes of getting a job building the Hoover Dam fell through, he found work as a tenant farmer in the area. "I think it's maybe where the Strip is now," said Duckett. A year later, they moved near Prescott, where relatives lived. Here, Duckett went to school, working at Walgreens in her senior year of high school to earn money for flying lessons. When the flight school in Holbrook, where she worked after high school, moved to Tucson, she moved with it. During the war, she also did riveting work one summer in Long Beach and lubricated the tail units of planes out at Ryan Field. But what she really wanted to do was to go to college. Armed with a tuition break from a sympathetic dean and a $100 loan from her flight instructor boyfriend, Duckett graduated from the University of Arizona in 1949. It was in college where she also got involved with car racing, thanks to a friend whose husband raced cars. Soon, she was selling tickets for races held in a former cornfield across from Gilpin Airlines on Tucson's north side. She also worked the ticket booth for the jalopy races held at the Tucson Rodeo Grounds. Here, she even drove a car during a qualifying heat for a powder puff race. "By the time I got around the track, the race was over," she said. From 1957 to 1974, Duckett worked as an administrative assistant for the Tucson Airport Authority. Still, she seemingly never lost her taste for adventure. In 1974, she went to work for a dozen years as a secretary for the U.S. Foreign Service in such locales as Mozambique, Swaziland, Yemen, and El Salvador. "It was lots of fun," said Duckett. "Maybe almost as much fun as racing motorcycles." Article number 5, Madeline Berger. "We had the mountains, we had the cacti, we had the wide open spaces. About all we were lacking, 8 or 9 decades ago, was a little culture. One time we had an opera with a death scene in the middle. After the death scene was over, everybody in the audience got up and went home. That's the tale Tucson pioneer Roy Drachman loved to tell. Into this cultural wasteland ventured Madeline Dreyfus Heinemann Berger, bringing with her an appreciation for the arts that culminated in 1927 with the creation of the Temple of Music and Art. Over the years, the Rocco building down on South Scott Street would host everyone from Jaska Heifetz playing the violin to Tallulah Bankhead emoting. Besides visiting artists, the building during its days also sheltered a number of permanent tenants, including the Tucson Little Theater, studios for dance, voice, and violin, a tea room, and something known as the Rishki Kornashny and Paravita Center. The temple also served as permanent home to its founding force, the Saturday Morning Musical Club. Not surprisingly, this too was begun by Madeline Berger, as she was known in her later years. Just who was this woman of refinement, and how did she become such a force in Tucson's fledgling art scene? She was born in Nevada City, California in 1875, said her nephew John Dreyfus. The Dreyfus family spells the last name at least five ways, he said. Hence Madeline's dropping the final S. After her father died, her mother ran the family bakery and brewery for a short time, then sold it and moved to Los Angeles. There, Madeline met and married Simon Heinemann, who, among other things, ran a liquor distributorship out of Tucson. Here, the couple settled about the turn of the century. Schooled in voice and piano, Madeline Heinemann soon began seeking out women in the community with similar arts leanings. In 1907, a few of these women gathered in Madeline Heinemann's Victorian parlor for the first meeting of the Saturday Morning Musical Club. Naturally, Mrs. Heinemann was the club's first president. At the end of its first session, the club had grown to 50 members who met in each other's homes and presented classical recitals by homegrown talent. In 1910, the group sponsored its first visiting artist, well-known singer Frida Langendorf. By 1914, the group was hiring an auditorium for its meetings and looking for a permanent home. A decade later, with membership rolls swelling, the club was still looking. That year, 1924, Simon Heinemann died. But Madeline's dream of a permanent home for the arts did not. 2 years later, she persuaded a wealthy winter resident, Alexander Berger, soon to be her brother-in-law, to donate $100,000 towards the building fund. The family gossip was that she originally set her sights on Alex, but he told her he was too old for her and sicked her on his brother Harry, said John Dreyfus. Madeline married Harry Berger, a Tucson investment broker, in 1928. Dreyfus also contended that Madeline and Alexander Berger struck a deal. He told her he would donate the money to the temple if she could raise $50,000 from Tucson merchants. She was very persuasive. November 1926. Metropolitan Opera Coloratoria soprano Amaletta Galli-Circa turns the first spadeful of dirt. The Temple of Music and Art goes from dream to reality. A year later, October 21, 1927, thousands turned out to hear a Spanish orchestra in costume play in the piano and to gawk at the red carpets, the pipe organ, the velvet curtains, and the oil paintings, including one of Madeline, which would grace the lobby of the temple for more than four decades. The following week, Jaska Heifetz became the first of many visiting artists who would play the temple, among the others Podaskrosk and Romanoff, Nelson Eddy, and Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. My aunt seemed to draw famous people and gather them around her, said John Dreyfus, who, as a boy, often visited his aunt in her home at 1 Pasco Redondo. But even the charms of Madeline Berger could not shield the temple from the Depression. After losing its tax-exempt status the year after it opened, the temple, for a time, became a motion picture theater. Audiences who a few months earlier had thrilled to Heifetz We're now watching Dolores del Rio in Ramona. In 1932, the Saturday Morning Musical Club offered the temple and its $65,000 mortgage to the city of Tucson. The city declined. Somehow, the temple persevered. In 1940, Madeline Berger stepped down as president of the Saturday Morning Musical Club after 30 seasons as its president. When she died in 1943, her funeral was held at the temple. "Everybody in the world was there," said Justina Keller, whose mother, Elizabeth Healy, was an early member of the club. For 35 years, her mother also worked at the temple, booking the acts. In the spring of 42, you could catch performances by Hyphus, pianist Jose and Amparo Iturbe, and tenor John Capara. A ticket to see the Iturbes, for example, would set you back $1.10, including tax. "Almost everyone you could think of played at the temple," said Keller. Tucson was a stop between El Paso and Los Angeles, so we got almost anybody you would expect. Audiences, turned out in best bib and tucker, were escorted to their seats by a dozen or so high school girls, recruited as usherettes. "We wore evening gowns and long white gloves," remembered ex-usherette Louise Stover, sister to John Dreyfus and niece of Madeline Berger. "After the performance started, we would all sit in the balcony and sneak cigarettes." Besides backing performances at the temple, the Saturday Morning Musical Club supported a number of musical clubs for Tucson youngsters. It sponsored twice weekly radio programs broadcast over KBOA. Sample programs from 1942, The Importance of Civil War Defense, and The New Art of Radio Writing. During summers, the unair-conditioned temple, like much of the town, shut down. "All the dance schools held their spring recitals at the temple," said Keller. "They used to open the doors and pray that it would be cool that day." In 1972, the same year the community center was built, the temple was sold and turned into a Mexican movie theater. Today, after a succession of former owners and a $2.9 million restoration in 1989, the ornate Spanish building is home to the Arizona Theater Company, its thespians reciting their lines on its vulnerable stage. Article number 6, Boilermaker Dick. You just never know sometimes how a story's going to arrive. A while back, I wrote a column that cited an old newspaper ad about a 1925 boxing match here in Tucson, featuring a man by the name of Boilermaker Dick. Didn't know a thing about the guy, just liked the sound of his name. Next day, I got a call from a woman with a message about as direct as they come. "I'm Boilermaker Dick's daughter." She was. "I think my father fought professionally for about 10 years, said Beatrice Amato Kissinger, whose father's given name was Ricardo Amato, part of a pioneer family that settled in Patagonia. "Even out of the rank, Boilermaker Dick liked to put up his dukes," said Kissinger. "He just liked to fight. We used to go to dances, and after every dance, my dad was always in a brawl." Her father and mother were childhood sweethearts who grew up in Patagonia, but married in Globe, where her father went to work in the mines. When the mines shut down, they came to Tucson about 1918, and he got a job with the Southern Pacific in the Roundhouse, said Kissinger. She figured that's where her dad picked up his nickname. It was a name that would stick with him long after he left the ring, and the Roundhouse, said Kissinger. People in Nogales called him Boilermaker Dick for years. Only my mother called him Ricardo. Born in the barrio in 1922, Kissinger hardly remembered her father's fights in Tucson, such as the eight-rounder he pulled back in 25 against Bob Mandel at the Tucson Garage, where ladies were cordially invited. "I used to hear a lot of conversations," said Kissinger. "My dad did a lot of street fighting in Barrio Anita." In 1928, her father was laid off from the Roundhouse, and the family, by then numbering five kids, moved back to Patagonia. She She had vague memories of attending fights inside canvas tents and being afraid someone would hurt her dad. I remember crying, "Don't hurt him! Don't hit him!" Alas, someone did deliver a punch serious enough to send her father to the hospital one time with a ruptured spleen, said Kissinger. Along the way, Boilermaker Dick hung up his gloves, at least professionally. Amateur hour was another matter. Every Saturday night, a dance was held in Patagonia, said Kissinger. It was a big social event with a band. At midnight, there would be a supper with tamales and coffee, and after every dance, my dad was in a fight. By the early 30s, the family had moved to Ruby, where Kissinger's dad and her older brother went to work at the mine. "We had such a good time in Ruby," said Kissinger, and every Saturday night, the family went to the dances, this time in Arivaca. "You guessed it. Afterwards, my dad would be in a fight," said Kissinger. "It was kind of a sport with him." Her parents left Ruby in the late 30s, and the family resettled in Patagonia. My dad worked some of the little mining claims, mostly silver. What's more, he was still throwing punches. "There was a little guy from Nogales who was always picking a fight with my dad," said Kissinger. After high school, she became a Navy nurse, married, and had 6 children. Her mother lived to be 98. Her father died at age 66. "He played hard," said the daughter of Boilermaker Dick. "He just beat himself to death." Article number 7, Johnny Gibson. Buildings came and buildings went as the Wreckers Ball flit-flitted round and round downtown Tucson. Still, some things endured, notably the buffalo head, the grainy photographs of men flexing their muscles, the smell of hair tonic, and the small, dark-haired fellow who presided over what may have been Tucson's last barbershop. "When I started, there were lots of barbershops downtown," said Johnny Gibson, who for more than 60 years cut hair and shaved whiskers at the same North 6th Avenue location. "Here is where our fathers and brothers went for their haircuts, while our mothers shopped the nearby Sears, Roebuck & Company just down the street. Go see if your father's done," my own mother would tell me. And so I would tiptoe into that male domain, cluttered with Police Gazette magazines and the gentle banter of men arguing baseball statistics or whether Ike would beat out Adlai Stevenson for a second term. Politics, sports, the state of downtown, they still talk that talk here at what once was Johnny Gibson's barbershop, sitting in the same yellow chairs in front of the same time-spattered mirrors. Everyone talks about downtown construction. "When I first started, they were just building the new Levi's," said Gibson. "We were just kids," said Gibson with a laugh, remembering that day spent with his best buddy, Art Easel. "I was 17 and he was 16. We got out our mother's old hair tools. We whittled on one another, and then his mother judged us. She said, 'John, it looks like you got the worst of the deal.'" Encouraged by that faint praise, Gibson started whittling on the heads of his friends and fellow paperboys. Originally from Humboldt, South Dakota, a 14-year-old Gibson and his mother moved to Tucson so that she could nurse a brother ailing with tuberculosis back to health. "I was most impressed with Tucson," Gibson recalled. "I rode home. They have 2 skyscrapers here," and they did, the Pioneer Hotel and the Valley National Bank. The little family settled into a rented house on a chicken ranch that would one day become what was known for years as Cliff Valley Golf Course. "It was 6 miles from town, and there were no buses," said Gibson. "I walked 2.5 miles to Amphi Junior High." During Gibson's junior year at Tucson High School, his mother, who was nursing a woman with TB, came down with the disease. To help make ends meet, Gibson signed up with the Civilian Conservation Corps and was sent to a camp on the Mogollon Rim. "I made $30 a month and sent $22 home," he said. And then fate, as it often does, sashayed right on in. "There were 200 guys at camp, plus the leaders, and 4 guys cutting hair," said Gibson. "But every 6 months they had a turnover. All the guys cutting hair left. With the camp bereft of barbers, Gibson got to thinking. I sent off $3.50 to Sears Roebuck for a set of barber tools, including the electric clippers. The first customer's clips came gratis. The next one cost 20 cents. Gibson recalled. He said, "You're not bad." I cut hair for the next 8 months, 20 cents apiece, at night after the regular day's work was done. Then I raised the price to a quarter. About the same time Gibson's two-year stint with the CCC was ending, his mother died. So Gibson took the $300 he had saved from skimming over the scalps of his campmates and took the bus to the nearest barber's college in Los Angeles. After graduating in May of 42, Gibson motored to Phoenix to take his state exams. Perusing the local pool halls, he found a likely head of hair on which to demonstrate his barbering prowess. I promised him $5 to do a shave, haircut, and massage, but the next day, he didn't show. Desperate, Gibbons ran out into the street and collared the first transient he found. I told him if he'd let me shave him and cut his hair, I'd pay him $5 and buy breakfast for him and for his buddy. Tucson's best-known barber thus became one by working on a man whose hair stuck out like dagwood, with a beard made of iron. Back in Tucson, Gibson scouted up his first barbering job at the old Santa Rita Hotel, making $28 a week. Soon after, World War II intervened. Volunteering as a paratrooper in the 101st Airborne, Gibson jumps into the Normandy invasion, was taken prisoner, worked in a German makeshift evacuation hospital, escaped, was found at Boston John, and eventually was shipped back to the United States. "After I recuperated, I went right back to Santa Rita," said Gibson. Glory days those, with Nick Hall running the hotel. The cattlemen and the cowboys all came in for their shaves, and they all mingled with the winter visitors, and all for 65 cents for a haircut, 35 cents for a shave. But Gibson, who had married Pearl Clam after the war, wanted his own business. He found it at the Old Palace Barbershop, for sale, $3,000. "The rent's still the same as it was 40 years ago," said Gibson. "So are the sinks, the tortoiseshell mirror, and the mop bucket he inherited." During the late 40s and the early 50s, Gibson was building his body as well as his business, earning the titles of Mr. Arizona in 1950 and Mr. Tucson in 1951. "My real interest was in competitive weightlifting," said Gibson, who still competes in senior events. "Times were good in the days when men and boys wore their hair short and everyone found occasion to come downtown." And then came the 60s. One by one, Tucson's stalwarts of the retail trade either shut down or moved to the suburbs. Meanwhile, hairstyles were creeping over ears and past collars. "Long hair was hard on the barber," said Gibson, who cut his first five-chair operation back to two chairs. "Barbershops are closing up right and left, right up to the 70s. But not the long, narrow shop at 53 North 6th Avenue. Somehow, it persevered long enough to see things come full circle. "We're now inundated with University of Arizona boys," said Gibson. "The rancheros and the cowboys still come in, too, as well as a slew of government workers," he said. "They hit us hard at lunch hour. And yes, you can still get a decent shave. We used strop razors with schick injections in them," Gibson said. "You can't hone and strop a razor that sharp. What you won't get here is a hair styling. There are no blow dryers, no curling irons, no mousse. We use crema oil," said Gibson firmly. "Very few are going to barber college anymore," he said with a sigh. "Now a guy can go in a beauty shop and get a haircut. Somewhere else, that is." "I like it here," said Gibson, taking in the row of hair tonics, the sporting magazines, the worn linoleum, I plan to stay here till the undertaker picks me up from right under my chair. Note, Johnny Gibson sold his shop, now called Curly's Downtown Barbershop, in 2001. As a publication, in 2006, he still cut hair there every Tuesday.
This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.